Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life. Good evening. Welcome to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie. Thanks so much for being with us tonight. This evening's guest is Dr. Susan Simpson, and she is a clinical psychologist. She graduated from York University in Toronto, Ontario in 1985 with a PhD in clinical psychology. She's registered in both Ontario and here in British Columbia, and she has an extensive background in working with individuals recovering from sexual abuse and childhood trauma, substance addiction, depression and anxiety states, stress-related challenges, relationship issues, pain management, and health issues, as well as trauma arising from accidents and violence. She works with people from all walks of life who seek solutions to life's challenges. Welcome to the show. Hi, Susan.
Hello, Marie.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing just great. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm really happy to be here talking with you. Been following some of your interviews and really admiring your work. And it's an honor to be with the Namaste community.
Thank you so much. Have you had a chance to check out namastepublishing.com?
Always, absolutely. I'm a big fan of Namaste.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for being with us. So you have a website, wavesofpotential.com, and you have a practice on Vancouver Island in Victoria, British Columbia. And can you tell us a little bit about what you do as a clinical psychologist?
Well, for the last 3.5 years, what I've been doing exclusively is a form of neurofeedback called brain state conditioning. As you very graciously let people know in your introduction, that my background is extensively in working with people with trauma. And I've always been one of those kinds of psychologists who is very open-minded and keeps looking for tools to really help people, because that was always my intention of being a psychologist, was to solve those solutions to those problems. It never made sense to me that people struggled in their lives and would have to bump up against limitations of who they were. So I was always on the lookout, and I did a lot of training beyond my PhD in breath work and rebirthing and hypnotherapy and EMDR and all those kinds of things. But it just felt to me like nothing new had happened in psychology for 150 years. And kept my eye on the biofeedback, neurofeedback field, which up until recently was very, very awkward and cumbersome and very difficult to use. And it was only when Brain State Technology began to develop their program that it became very, very user-friendly and got me very, very excited about training with it and making it available to people in my practice. So the talk therapy that we use in psychology, the cognitive behavioral therapy that's still the predominant paradigm, is very, very limited. It excludes so much of who we are as human beings and what our potential is. And the bottom line is that it doesn't work very well. It doesn't really allow people to change, to overcome the problems that they have, and to really live a full life. So the neurofeedback is a different kind of approach altogether. I'm more excited about it than I've ever been excited about anything in my life, because it works. As a professional, as a psychologist, I feel like it's Christmas morning every morning when I come to work, because I'm able to offer this incredible technology to people. So if I can explain a little bit about where I'm coming from, where kind of the larger picture is for me in terms of people and life and healing and spiritual development and the brain. I'm speaking to this particular Namaste audience is a real pleasure for me because I can kind of go beyond the boundaries of how I would usually talk to a more conventional audience or a more sort of mainstream public audience. So I feel like I can push the boundaries a little bit of what my belief system is. And I think we're here as manifestations of consciousness. That's what reality is all about. That's why we're here. There's consciousness that takes a formless state, and there's consciousness that manifests itself in form. And our human bodies, our natural world, and particularly our brain, are the form that consciousness manifests itself through, and particularly the brain. So in my experience, the brain is sort of the instrument through which consciousness comes through into this world of form. And the whole point of it is to bring more and more consciousness into form, and I think that happens through the brain as an instrument. So I don't think we are our brain. I don't think we are our mind. The mind is beyond the brain, and awareness is beyond the mind as well. But the fascinating part is that the brain is the interface through which consciousness manifests itself, and I believe is becoming increasingly available in form. It's kind of like there's more consciousness in form increasingly, and that's what our current culture and time is all about. So the degree to which the brain itself is impeded, whether it's because it's been injured or it's overwhelmed or it's been traumatized, which is my area of interest, which I think trauma, there's lots of evidence that repeated trauma and cross-generational trauma is really at the foundation of a lot of the difficulties that we have as human beings. The degree to which the brain is limited in its functioning is going to be the degree to which our consciousness is limited. So by working with the brain directly, we're directly working with expanding consciousness, which affects everything that we do and our humanity in general. There's many ways to work with the brain. Meditation is a really strong one. There's different approaches in meditation. And I can kind of go into why it's so powerful. But the neurofeedback that I use is a direct way of accessing the brain and how it's functioning. So neurofeedback uses EEG equipment. So sensors are put on the head measuring the brainwave activity, and we map the patterns of the brain and identify the areas that are dysfunctional, and then use software technology to feed back information to the brain and gently nudge it into a much more balanced state. So, for example, thinking about Eckhart Tolle and his concept of the pain body, which is something you and I emailed about a little bit, that's really fascinating because the brain that we're working with right now is really 12,000 years old. It hasn't really changed. You know, the last evolution was when we were hunters and gatherers, and the brain was designed to function in this environment where signs of danger were very, very different than the way that they are right now. So our brain really has to kind of catch up to the fact that there's danger and stress and complexity and overstimulation in every second of our lives, in every second of our day. And the brain is designed for survival. So the control center of the brain is the emotional center, the limbic system. And it's all about trauma. It's all about recording trauma, making sense of trauma. So beginning in childhood, the day-to-day experiences of the child to the degree that they're traumatic or non-traumatic and supportive and loving lays the foundation of how the brain is going to function. You know, growing up in a family that is unpredictable, that is violent, that is doesn't meet the child's needs, the brain perceives those dangers in the environment and begins to organize itself in and around that stress and that trauma, and begins to develop this perception of the world as a dangerous, unsafe place, and a perception of the self as being in danger. And people are different in terms of what kind of strategies they choose in order to cope with that. And all of that becomes hardwired into the brain. So that's why it's very, very difficult to change those patterns. People who've had much, much more trauma at earlier times in life, their brains are much less flexible and much less responsive to treatment interventions than people that haven't.
So, Dr. Simpson, when you talk about the brain being hardwired, we also want to talk about neuroplasticity. So, is the brain plastic or is the brain hardwired, or is it a combination?
Well, see, this is where we get into the rabbit hole. It's both. So on the one hand, there is this very, very definite structure that the brain develops itself around, right? On the other hand, it's what we're discovering and has been really well established in the last 10 years is that the brain is immensely adaptable and changeable. So the hardwiring part of it, the motivation of that comes from survival. It's almost like the brain is very, very superstitious. So it's like this terrible thing happened. I responded in this way and it worked because I survived, right? Like, for example, people that learn to please others as a way of getting through life. And it becomes almost like a compulsive strategy for them, right? The motivation for that is survival. The plasticity comes in that the brain can change itself, is immensely changeable. So we've discovered that through very, very concrete things like people that have strokes and injuries. According to the old model of the brain that saw it as hardwired and non-changeable, when you made an injury to a certain part of the brain, it shouldn't be able to recover. Another part of the brain should not take over that function. But reality and life demonstrated over and over again that was actually what was happening to people. People were recovering from strokes, and even though on a scan you could still see that area of damage in their brain where the stroke had happened, another part of the brain had taken over, say the speech function or the motor function on the right side of the body or something like that. So it was very, very evident in physical kinds of things that the brain was really, really plastic. So with our current advances in technology of being able to study the brain, you know, up until 15 years ago, we couldn't even really study the brain without immense damage. You know, some of those old images of having to crack the skull and insert these horrible long needles into the brain in order to stimulate it and study what this part was doing, what that part was doing. It was hard to get a lot of volunteers for those studies, right? But now we've got all of these non-invasive, non-harmful ways of looking at the brain in real time. And one of those technologies is the EEG, because you can hook people up without any kind of intrusiveness, without any kind of radiation. You're just reading their brain waves, and you can determine what kinds of changes are happening in split second in real time. So we know now that, A, the brain maintains its ability to grow new cells throughout the whole lifetime. Even when you're 90 years old, you can still grow new brain cells. You can actually heal brain cells. And the most important part of what goes on in the brain is the connections between the cells, between the neurons. So the brain is all about systems and circuits and communication. And that's what the most important part of the, of neuroplasticity comes in, is that as if you change the behavior, if you change awareness even, I'll get into that in a second, let's stay with the behavior for a minute. If you change the behavior in an intentional, mindful kind of way, you're actually going to change the neural nets, the connections between those nerves and those neurons. So, for example, in the example of the stroke patient, right? So some of the rehab that people go through now when they've had a stroke is that they will say their right hand has been paralyzed. That means that they've had a stroke on the left side of the brain. The right arm is paralyzed. So on a daily basis, they go through these hours and hours of moving that arm. So exercising that arm isn't about the muscles in the arm. It's about developing new connections between the nerves and the muscles in the arm and the motor centers in the brain. Okay. So now we have studies that show us that you can make those neural connections without the physical movement. If you actually sat and thought about and rehearsed in the mind the movement, the brain will make those connections and the arm will improve. It's really exciting and very, very fascinating. There's a whole series of studies on how people can learn how to play the piano. So people that are non-musical had never played before, and there was a group of people who were brought in, and they were actually taught how to play the piano, and they would come in and practice for a couple of hours every day. And then a group of people who were introduced to the piano and taught how to play, and they would play for an hour, and then for the second hour, they would actually just rehearse it in their mind. And then this third group of people who just came in and looked at the piano and read and did other things, right, as a control group. And it turned out that the second group of piano players who played the piano a little bit but did most of the mental rehearsal were actually much more proficient in it than the people who practiced it physically.
Wow.
Right. So then that's where the consciousness, the meditation part comes in. That's the power of meditation, is that, say, with the trauma example, right, if we're practicing meditation, which is essentially is about quieting certain areas of the brain, suspending those thoughts, suspending those functions of the brain that's into survival, into looking for danger, into being guarded, right? In the moment of meditation, it's about letting go and allowing yourself to be calm and quiet. And in that context of awareness, becoming aware of what the program is, what the thoughts are, and consciously allowing them to change, questioning the truth of them, of not believing your thoughts. And so the first step is that you're quiet. The second step is that you become aware of what you're thinking. And the third step is that you question the truth of what you're believing and thinking. And the fourth is that you make another choice about what you believe. So in neurofeedback, that whole process is intensified and speeded up and made much, much more automatic, because the brain receives that kind of information on a neural level and makes those changes by itself in very quick.
So with the brain state conditioning and the neural feedback, I have some questions about that. You said that you use an EEG monitor.
EEG equipment, sensors. Yeah,
to find out what's going on with the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then what kind of information is being sent? You put sensors on, and are you using, like, electrical pulses, or what exactly is going into the brain?
Oh, nothing is going into the brain. If we use the example of biofeedback, it's a little bit easier to understand because it's simpler and it's the same principle that's going on with neurofeedback. So in biofeedback, which happened earlier and is much more well established, say something like teaching someone how to control their heart rate, how fast their heart is beating. Okay, so you would take EKG equipment, you would take equipment, sensors, that measure the electrical activity of the heart. Right. Now that's practically everyone has seen that on TV and in movies, right? You've got these little sensors taped onto the person's chest, and there's a monitor there, and you see these little blips on the screen, and that's the heart rate. That's the heart, the electrical activity of the heart. By feeding that information back to the person, just by letting them hear the amplified heart rate, they can, by their own volition, slow it down. Now, if you add a little bit more information to that, sort of other sounds that tell them to, when they're going out of range or when they're within range, like rewarding sounds that tell you that you're within range and other sounds that tell you you're without range, you're out of range, very rapidly people learn how to control their heart rate, their blood pressure, all kinds of physiological things. So do you understand that principle?
I do. So with the brain, with the neurofeedback, are you feeding sounds back to the patient?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So it's like brain sounds, what your brain sounds like?
Sounds in addition to visual information as well. So the EEG part of it is the sensors. They're electrodes, they're sensors that we place on the head, and all they do is pick up the brainwave activity, the electrical activity of the brain. Now, the heart is about 30 times stronger than the brain. The brain is much more subtle and, of course, much, much more complex than the heart. So we use much, much more sensitive sensors that just pick up the brainwave activity, and then the software makes sense of it. It converts, say, we're looking at the frontal lobes, which is the most evolved part of the brain. It's where we make decisions and we control our impulses and we become aware. It's kind of the seat of awareness in a way. So if we're picking up activity in the frontal lobes, each area of activity is kind of like an instrument in a band. And the more that this certain frequency of activity is active, that instrument is going to be a lot louder in that band. And if they're not working together in synchrony, then the band is going to sound like terrible musicians just kind of tuning up, right? They're not cooperating, they're not in tune with each other, they're not in harmony with one another. So by taking that music, that brainwave activity that's been converted into computer-synthesized sounds and feeding it back to the brain, to the person through earphones, it's kind of like feeding back the heart rate to them. It sounds very simple, but it's incredibly profound information. It's like when you're driving in your car and you're trying to regulate your speed, if you can watch your speedometer, you can regulate your speed very, very precisely. If you can't see your speedometer, you're kind of hitting and missing and guessing about it. So just by feeding that information about the activity to the brain, it can sort of see itself in a mirror. And then there's other little sounds interwoven in there that give it a little bit more information about nudging it in one direction or another. You know, quieting down in this area, activating in that area, increasing communication between certain areas. So let's say, for example, the frontal lobe activity example. So people with attention deficit, they tend to have an overabundance of low-frequency activity in the frontal lobes. Right? So that's why kids with attention deficit or learning disabilities are given Ritalin, a stimulant, because it stimulates the higher frequency activity. But it's kind of like having one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake. It's not a very effective way of getting through life. With the neurofeedback, what happens is that the brain is fed back that information that it's overactive in a certain way, and it is encouraged to change that activity pattern in something that's more conducive. Now, one of the things that's operating there is, just like the rest of our body, is designed to go into balance. our bodies are designed to be healthy, to balance themselves and to go into equilibrium, you know, to kind of find the most efficient pathway of operating. And our brain is exactly the same way. When you allow it to go into a pattern that's much more balanced, it will go into that pattern and stay into that pattern. Because it went into that other non-efficient pattern for a reason. Remember the example of the kid that's traumatized early in life and learns how to lays down these certain brain patterns and learns how to go into this particular kind of behavior to survive by kind of giving the brain the opportunity to see that it's doing that. It allows it to come into present time and change, because it doesn't need to do that anymore. You know, the trauma isn't present anymore.
You mentioned the attention deficit disorder. What are some of the, and also you deal with trauma, what about things like schizophrenia? Can that be helped by neurofeedback?
Well, those questions are always interesting to answer. I've had just incredible, mind-blowing surprises with this technology, with this approach. So schizophrenia is a complex sort of disorder that involves multiple systems. And again, you know, at this stage in my career, I'm really uncomfortable. I really resist using labels and boxes like that, right? So something like schizophrenia, we use it as a label and we think we know what it means. But if you have, you know, 30 people that are diagnosed with that disorder in a room, you're going to get 30 very, very different individuals, right? So the endpoint of the diagnosis of schizophrenia can often be a combination of very different things, metabolic contributions, biochemical contributions, trauma in childhood, trauma later on, drug-induced, a psychotic break at some early point in the life that kind of disrupts the electrical activity of the brain. I have a number of schizophrenic people that I have worked with very, very successfully with brain training. With most of them, even though they were on medication, there was some very significant early success in the reduction, say, of hearing voices and visual hallucinations and very, very deep depression and that kind of thing. So those symptoms improved, but they wouldn't hold over time. So with a lot of the changes through neurofeedback, the changes hold. You don't have to keep doing the process over and over again. But with this, in this particular case, in the whole category of schizophrenia, I found that by having regular sessions with people, once they reach a certain level of functioning, by having regular maintenance sessions with them, that they're allowed to that allows them to actually kind of expand their life and make different kinds of choices and change things, like getting out into society and having a job and not being depressed or suicidal and all that, getting off medication, all of that kind of thing. And they differ according to when, you know, what's the optimal. Sometimes for some people it's having a session once a week, and for some people it's having a session once a month, and for some people it's coming in every few months for two or three sessions in a row. So bipolar is another one that's really, it's kind of the schizophrenia of our generation these days. Bipolar is becoming much, much more predominant than it used to be. And the effectiveness of the neurofeedback is quite astounding and you know, impressive as well. And that seems to be an individual kind of thing. I have several clients who you know, finished their course of treatment and in two or three years have never had to come back. And there's some people that will go out and they will encounter some kind of crisis and then will come back for a few sessions, kind of like a tune-up or something like that. See, what happens, the fascinating thing that happens is when the brain changes, the perspective changes. You know, it's like the person isn't different than who they are. They're just themselves. They're themselves without those limitations on them. And then their perspective of life changes, their idea about the world changes, their idea about themselves and what they're capable of changes, and they start making different choices. And so sometimes they encounter situations that are really, really challenging for them. And so they just need to come back and do some more work on a deeper level.
Dr. Simpson, you said when someone's brain changes, their perspective changes. So would it be possible for the opposite, for when someone's perception changes, their brain would also be able to change?
Yes. Yes, that's the other way that's coming in from the other direction that I was talking about, say, with meditation. That's the whole point of psychotherapy as well. The work that Byron Katie does, it's all about that. It's, you know, questioning your thoughts. The thoughts have become hardwired. They've become automatic. And when you bring awareness to them and start questioning the thoughts and start questioning the beliefs, you're interrupting that circuitry. You're interrupting those connections, the hardwiring that's become automatic in the brain. And as you make other choices, the connections follow those emotional, psychological choices.
So would you say that the brain conditioning would give you a similar result, but maybe in a little bit more of a passive way, where you're not so having to actively remind yourself to catch your thoughts?
It's a much more efficient, effective, faster, you know, it happens very, very quickly. It happens within days and weeks rather than years of working on it. So using, say, neurofeedback, brain conditioning, and meditation, having some sessions of brain conditioning changes meditation. It advances it. I used to be a big-time meditator. I was, you know, one of those people that meditated for years, did a lot of work with Deepak Chopra, taught meditation to all my clients. But, you know, the most common complaint that you hear from people is, I can't quiet my mind. I just can't stop my mind from thinking. And, you know, they're frustrated with it, and it's not always fulfilling for them. Well, with brain training, with interrupting all of those automatic thoughts and those automatic circuits, then the meditation changes very dramatically and becomes much, much more effective. The spiritual work that I was striving for of, you know, personally myself, of living in the present moment and being in the now and going through the day in silence and in presence without being inundated by 100 thoughts a minute, those become normal. Once the brain is balanced, because it means that a lot of the old history has been, the charge of the old history has been eliminated, has been erased, and all there is the present. You know, I'm not being driven by what happened to me in childhood, the fears and the strategies that I developed then. It's really quite incredible. So I don't see it as, I see it as all of that working together, you know, working at, from different strategies and different approaches. There's a place for counseling and psychotherapy and having people become aware of who they are and what their issues are and what is really going on in their mind, what thoughts they're having. There's a place for meditation, and there's a place for neurofeedback. And for nutrition as well. Nutrition is a very important part of how the brain is functioning and how we're feeling.
So it sounds like there's not just one route. There's multiple ways to achieve this balance, and there's also multiple things that you would need to do in conjunction to really be a balanced individual.
Yeah. It's a really exciting time in history right now because we're just having an explosion of information and understanding. And I think for me, because it's been such a long road of investigating of, how do people change? How can we let go of these things that limit us, of this baggage that weighs us down? Why do we have to carry the past into the present moment and have it ruin our lives? And what happened when you were at 5 years old is affecting what's going on with you at 50 or 30. My whole professional and personal life has been about exploring that and about, investigating ways of how to change and heal and that sort of thing. My mind, my thoughts are very fluid and very open about what works and what contributes and what's valuable. I think, and just appreciating how different we all are. We're different in where we're starting from or where we are right now. We're different in what's been resolved and what hasn't been resolved, and we're different in what's out of balance and what's not out of balance. So it's very, very individual in terms of what people need at every given time. I think the best authority is themselves. I think we as individuals know we're kind of given an inner intuitive guidance about what we need. But to sort of think that any one thing is going to be the answer, I just don't believe that anymore. Like meditation was the answer. That was, the whole belief of, the spiritual level is the highest, and what is happening above is going to affect what's happening below. But I don't think it's enough. I think it's a very, very important tool and a very important aspect. But I think people also need to do a lot of people, not everyone. The spiritual path works for a lot of people. But I think some people also need to do a lot of psychological and emotional work in order to clear up some of their circuits so that that spirituality can flow through them.
Definitely. Well, if you have a question, we are talking with Dr. Susan Simpson. She is a clinical psychologist with a PhD in clinical psychology, and she is located in Victoria, British Columbia. If you have a question and you'd like to get on the air, give us a call at 1-347-202-0129. That's 347-202-0129. Or you can pop into the chat room and ask your question. I will pass it on to Dr. Simpson. So, Susan, before we talk more about the brain conditioning, because I'm really interested in hearing more about it, but what actually happens to the brain when I know that there's a group of people on Twitter who have lost their spouses at a young age, and some of them may be listening tonight, and I can imagine that would be a really traumatic experience to lose someone so close.
Mm-hmm.
Through some kind of like drastic traumatic, like an accident or something like
mm-hmm.
that. What actually happens in the brain when we experience something like that?
Well, there's a number of different things that happen. So one of the aspects that's important is what has happened to that person up until then. What is their history? What is their perspective of the world? How secure are they in themselves? Do they see life as very, very dangerous and unpredictable? Do they see themselves as powerless? It's kind of like what condition does the person show up for that trauma? So that's why traumas will affect people differently, because they're different in how they're going to respond and what their history is. So losing a spouse at a young age, so factors like how did that happen? You know, how did the loss happen? Was it health related? You know, was it a senseless accident? Parents who lose children have a very, very, very difficult time recovering from that. So it's related to what meaning they give to that event, to the loss of that partner, and what it means to them, and what it says to them about what life is like. So the people that are having a really, really hard time with it, they get sort of into this loop of grief of life is over, life will never be the same, there is no way out of this, and just getting very kind of that's the effect of trauma in the brain. It's so overwhelming that it actually becomes this feedback loop, this closed loop that just reverberates and reverberates through it. When we actually look at the brain under a scan, when we're looking at a physical trauma, say like a laser beam that's been sort of for experimental purposes that's been put into an area of the brain and creates some damage, the damage itself actually heals very, very quickly, but the brain develops this outer shell, this circuitry around it to protect it. And it's the circuitry, it's the protection, the defense that creates the limitation. Okay, so having a tragic event like, you know, there's some people, there's a person that I'm just working with right now where both of their parents were killed in a motorcycle accident by a drunk driver who had stolen a vehicle and was involved in a series of criminal activities, and it just ended in this very, very violent car accident. So that experience is so overwhelming to the life system that it just becomes, the brain becomes overwhelmed, and it just kind of goes into shock, and sometimes doesn't come out of it, sometimes takes a long, long time to come out of it. So with the brain training, when we hook that person up, they're actually able to let go of that closed circuit of the trauma reverberating through them all the time. The circuit is broken, and they're given, it's kind of like the process is allowed to move through, right? So the grieving is actually moves ahead. That's the purpose of grieving, is to transition you from the loss into continuing life, right? But when it's been so traumatic, there's this kind of stuckness that happens. And with brain training, that stuckness is opened up, and people are allowed to go and process their grieving and get to the other end of it. It doesn't mean that they're not going to be having all of those feelings and those memories and those experiences, but they're going to be more prepared to move through it and make more sense out of it, come to peace with it, I guess, is another way to put it.
Wonderful. Well, we have a question, a caller on the line, so I'm just going to bring them up if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Ready? Okay. So from area code 603, you're on the air. What's your question? Hello?
Hello? Hello?
Hi, what's your question?
Hi, I'm sorry. I was muted. I have a question. In the early 80s, I was probably one of the first to be used in used ADD medication. Not for hyperactive, but for attention deficit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a long time ago, and now I'm 34 now, and I have anxiety issues and problems. I'm wondering if that could be linked to the use of that through probably third to about seventh grade.
Well, it's possible. The medication is certainly going to change the chemistry of the brain. I'm not sure what medication you're talking about, how long you used it.
I believe back then it was non-generic. It was Ritalin at the time.
Ritalin,
it was, it was the first time it was used and prescribed, kind of.
And so you used it from like eighth grade.
No, to third grade till about seventh grade.
Yeah. It's a difficult question. Causality, you know, what causes what is a difficult question to answer because anxiety can be part of attention deficit as well in learning disabilities, right? It's just that as a child, it's expressed differently.
Right.
You know, medication is a really difficult issue for me to speak about. On the one hand, when it's necessary, it's necessary. It has to be used. But to give medication to a child whose brain is just developing, right? That medication is going to alter the development of that brain.
That's what I was kind of getting at.
Yeah, so the brain is going to be different than it would have been without that chemical intervention.
All right. You answered my question completely. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for calling in.
That doesn't mean that you can't do something about it.
No, I'm trying. I just actually had a 3 years ago, had a traumatic brain injury, and that is one of the things they're trying to use to help it, and so that's why I was asking. I just been sent a pain. I had a traumatic brain injury. I had a craniotomy. Hello.
Yeah. And so my question is, are you?
So like I've been sent a pamphlet from the neurologist and neuroscientist. And they want to know if I would like to be involved in a study using Ritalin or methamphetamine.
Oh, okay.
And so that's why I was asking, because that's something I had taken when I was younger, and I'm wondering if they're saying it has effects on, you know, good effects on people who have had traumatic brain injuries on remembrance or focusing or.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's going to work the same way as attention deficit, right? It's going to stimulate the higher frequencies.
All right, so it'll give me more anxiety. That's what I thought, probably.
It could.
It sounds like, caller, that you have some concerns about the medication. I would imagine that, and I don't want to speak for Dr. Simpson, but probably the best person to talk to about these concerns would be your neurologist and letting them know your background and your concerns about what might happen if you were to participate in the study.
Yeah, I'm just very skeptical on doctors and their ways and their beliefs. So. But I thank you very much for taking the time to answer my questions. And
all right. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Have a great night.
All right. You have a blessed evening.
And good luck with whatever you decide to do.
All right. Namaste. Oneness.
Namaste. Bye-bye. So, Dr. Simpson, for someone like that who is experiencing anxiety, what are some of the things that you would do in your practice to help them with healing from the anxiety?
Well, in a regular psychotherapy practice, you would sort of explore with the person the underlying thoughts and beliefs that are generating the anxious feelings. With the brain conditioning, we assess the brain and identify the areas that are out of balance. With anxiety, it's very, very often an overactivity in certain centers of the brain. Quite a bit of the time, it can be overactivity in the frontal lobes. So there's kind of like a hypervigilance, a worrying about things, even though there really isn't a lot in the environment to worry about. Little things become very, very worrisome. The need to really control the environment, which, you know, it's not ever possible to completely control the environment, right? So with the neurofeedback, we would retrain the brain to lower the activity in those overactive areas. That's a pretty easy pattern to break and to maintain. It's one of the most common brain patterns that we see, where certain areas of the brain are overactive in the higher frequencies. So it's kind of like, you know, the brain is on high octane. You know, it's overstimulated, it's overfunctioning, and it can get tuned down.
So what about back to the caller that we just had, who has, like, he actually had a physical brain injury in addition to the past Ritalin use and the ADHD or ADD, mm-hmm. rather. Do people with physical brain trauma, are they able to be helped by the brain conditioning?
It's the same principle. Certain brain areas are injured, and that usually can mean different things. Anxiety isn't an unusual side effect of brain injury. That often generates, you think of brain injury that area of the brain stops to function, but it's actually the opposite. It's kind of like it goes into hyperactivity. So there's head injury programs where, again, just like the stroke people, you can go through exercises both physically and mentally to stimulate the brain to kind of change itself. So it's possible to do it that way. There's, you know, brain injury programs that do that. With the neurofeedback, it's just going directly into the brainwave patterns and encouraging the brain to change itself, you know, giving the brain the information so that it can change into a more balanced state. Because, the brain is always trying to solve an issue. With the brain, if there's a brain injury, what happens is that the brain is trying to compensate for that brain injury, but it maintains the compensation long after it's needed. And by giving it more up-to-date information and giving it alternatives, it can go into a more balanced equilibrium state, into a more level state, you know, which is its nature. So that's why all this stuff works, because it works with the wisdom of the body, with the organic integrity of the brain, because it's perfectly natural for the brain to go into that direction. That's why it's so effective.
Wonderful. Well, we could talk about this all night, and we only have a few minutes left. Before we start to wrap up the show, I just want to say that Dr. Susan Simpson is going to be back on the show again. We're going to be doing kind of, a three-part series about the brain. Next time, would you like to specifically focus more on brain and spirituality?
Sure, we could do that.
Cool,
yeah.
Okay. So we'll schedule that with you. But I'm wondering, we have just 5 minutes left in the show, what would you like to leave the listeners with this evening?
Well, the place that I'm at in all of this is that we're, you know, at a very, very exciting time. We're in a time of incredible, incredible stress and conflict and complexity and contradiction and paradox. And I see it all as a very, very, very positive time. It's hard to get, when you're in the middle of something like this, it's hard to have a perspective on it. But what I was talking about, the brain and how it hasn't evolved for thousands of years, and now it's kind of in the birth chamber, you know, it's in the crunch right now, and it's going to evolve, or it's going to pop into a whole different state of being. It's going to evolve into a higher level of complexity so that it can deal with the things that life is throwing at us, that our culture and our times are throwing at us right now. I just encourage people to really keep an open mind. There's just so much information on a daily basis. We're burning through discoveries every single day on a weekly, monthly basis all the time. And it's kind of like, you know, trying to describe what an elephant is like just by examining the tail of the elephant, you know, that you examine the tail in very minute detail and you know all about it, and then you think you know all about the elephant and about the jungle and its environment and all of that. There's just so much we don't know. You know, the science of physics, even quantum physics, they know there's 99% of the world that they call dark matter that they don't know about. You know, there's 90% of the brain that, you know, I'm sure you've heard that common phrase that we only use 10 to 15% of our brain. Well, we use all of our brain, but we don't know very much about 90% of it. And what we know now is like 1,000 times more than what we knew 10 years ago. So it's a very, very hopeful time. My message for people is to, you know, plug into the information like the Namaste site. Plug into groups of people and communities where this information is being shared in a positive kind of way. The potential for this blossoming, for this rebirth that's happening right now is just tremendous.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Susan Simpson, your website, wavesofpotential.com, is that the best place to contact you?
That's a good place, yeah.
Okay.
There's an email address on there.
Wonderful. And if people are interested in getting the brain state conditioning, do they have to go travel to Victoria to see you, or are there other people who do it if they're, say, somewhere in the States or something?
Yes, there's lots of other people. The head office of Brain State Technologies is in Scottsdale, Arizona. That's where the developer, Lee Gertis, of the system has his head office. He's actually a Namaste author. Lee Gertis wrote the book called Limitless You, which is a Namaste publishing book. It's available on the website, and he talks about the brain and brain training much more extensively in that book. So he's the developer of this software technology that I'm talking about, and there's probably 150 offices around the world that do this brain state conditioning. So the other website for information is the brainstatetechnologies.com website. So brainstatetechnologies.com. And one of the tabs on that website is offices where you can access the services that are more local.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. I wish all night about this, but you will be back on Namaste Radio so we can talk more about the brain and spirituality. Thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure, and the brain and spirituality is a really exciting topic, so I look forward to that.
Wonderful. Yay, I'm excited. Okay, so thanks again, and have a great night.
Thank you, Marie.
Take care. So again, that was Dr. Susan Simpson. She is a clinical psychologist based out of Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, and her website is wavesofpotential.com, and there's lots more information about brain state conditioning and her practice, the benefits. There's FAQs, frequently asked questions, and all of that. So thank you so much for being with us this evening. Thank you to the caller who called in. Thank you for listening and connecting with us. If you would like to connect further, please visit namastepublishing.com, where you can talk about this episode and all of the authors and members of Namaste Global Community. Again, that is namastepublishing.com. Have a wonderful evening. Blessings to you. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.